Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Senate Occasional Lecture today. I want to just convey the apologies of Harry Evans, Clerk of the Senate, described this morning in the newspapers as the fiercest defender of democracy in the country, who has a bit of a flu today, so he's not that fierce. He's barking, but not in the way Michelle Grattan was suggesting. So he does send his apologies today. Our lecturer today is Professor George Williams. George Williams is the Anthony Mason Professor of Law and Foundation Director of the Gilbert and Tobin Centre of Public Law at the Faculty of Law in the University of New South Wales. He's written and edited many books, including A Charter of Rights for Australia, Australian Constitutional Law and Theory, and the Oxford Companion to the High Court of Australia. I think it's nice that the High Court has a companion. He practices as a barrister and has appeared in the High Court in cases involving such fundamental matters as freedom of speech, freedom from racial discrimination, and the rule of law. George is a media commentator on legal issues. He's written for all of Australia's major newspapers and made many television and radio appearances as an on-air legal analyst making sense of legal matters for the masses. In 2005, he chaired the Victorian Human Rights Commission Consultation Committee that led to the enactment of the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. This experience, among his other accomplishments, makes him an ideal commentator, media or otherwise, on the current debate on the need for and nature of human rights protections in Australia. Last year, his ideas, along with those of all the other participants in the governance stream at the 2020 summit, sank without a trace. Unperturbed, he returns here today to discuss the role of Parliament under an Australian Charter of Human Rights. Professor George Williams.
Well, thank you, I think, for that introduction, that generous introduction. And in beginning, I'd like to acknowledge the Aboriginal peoples of this land, the First Nations of this area, and pay my respects. I'd also like to pay my respects to the Senate as an institution and to really thank the Senate and to Harry Evans for the invitation to talk to you about this issue today. It's a genuine pleasure to have the chance to talk in Parliament about issues of human rights. And I'd begin by saying that I think Parliament is the right place that we should be talking about issues of human rights, that Parliament ought to be the central institution for the better protection of human rights of Australians, and that what I'm going to hope to do in this lecture today is really shift focus from what we've seen, which has largely been a public debate about the evils of unelected judges, to shift the debate to perhaps or how can better human rights protection improve the performance of Parliament. How can it improve the work of our representatives to actually lead to better human rights outcomes and, I think, better institutional mechanisms that will improve the way our democracy works? I'll talk about five things. I want to start with a bit of background, particularly for people who haven't caught up on the debate, just to put the debate in context. I'll talk about whether the Federal Parliament does need a Charter of Human Rights from the perspective of the Parliament and its operation. I'll then talk thirdly about whether it should be the Parliament or the courts who should be the primary rights protector. Fourthly, I'll talk about the model that I'm referring to, the parliamentary rights model, the charter that I believe Australia should have. And finally, I'll look at the evidence. What does the record show when it comes to parliaments and human rights under this type of model? Well, firstly, by way of background, it's important to recognise that Australia now is the only democratic nation in the world that does not have a national human rights law like a Bill of Rights, a Charter of Rights, or a Human Rights Act. Now, I start with that advisedly because a recent opinion poll asked Australians, do we have a national Bill of Rights? And 61% said yes. Now, it's a large audience, and I think immediately I should start by informing those people who aren't sure we do not have a national Bill of Rights. I've also seen on first-hand experience on many occasions Australians who think we've got this type of law. When I chaired the Victorian process, I ran into Victorians who said, I don't support a Charter of Rights Victoria. Given the national one, I don't think we need two of these. When I asked these people what was in this instrument, this Federal Bill of Rights, what they usually said was, I know freedom of speech is the first thing that's protected. But what came up disturbingly often was that they also knew that if they were in court, the Bill of Rights they had meant that they could take the fifth. And this perhaps gives you a sense of the contemporary debate in Australia. And not only does it give cause for concern, but particularly at an individual level, it gives you, I think, a sense of why people often feel so alienated and distanced from their system. They don't have the information they need to properly understand the system. And when confronted with a problem that actually goes to the heart of their human rights, they discover, to their own peril, that they lack the protections that they assume they have. We are the only democratic nation that does not have a Bill or Charter of Rights, and it means that we are the only democratic nation that when Australians and non-Australians are faced with fundamental questions of human rights, they lack that important check and balance. In fact, around the world, these type of instruments are now just seen as an essential part of what it means to a democracy. They're often the foundation upon which you build a democracy. So when you talk about what it means to live in the United States, we often start with the Bill of Rights. Even in the United Kingdom now, you will start with the Human Rights Act. It is the pillar upon which institutions operate. It's that fundamental piece of the architecture that explains how the system works for the citizens and works for people who are not citizens. It's the fundamental part of what it means to be a democratic system because you set out things like freedom and the right to vote. That's why when people outside look at our system, it looks decidedly odd in this modern age. And I've had the great fortune in some ways of forging an academic career where I constantly am invited to give talks around the world on what it's like to live in the only democratic country without a Bill of Rights, because for them it is decidedly odd that we don't have this institution, this law, that for them is just as essential as to have a parliament and the separation of powers and the like. Now, I start with that point because I think it is important to reflect on how different we are in Australia, but it's not by itself an argument for what I'm proposing. There are actually many things about Australia that are unique that we should retain. The fact that we're different is not a good argument for reform, but the fact that we are different is an important fact that needs to be inserted into the debate, and it has enormous consequences for the debate and for the lecture that I'm going to give today. The most important consequence is that in thinking about should we have this change, it means we can make that decision based upon hard empirical evidence across the democratic world which spans decades. The questions that we need to examine are largely answered in those other countries. There have been both successes and failures in those nations when it comes to good human rights protection. And we have the distinct advantage in coming last, stone cold last, that we can actually look to those systems and work out what we want to adopt, what we want to jettison. And I'd say immediately to you today that there are aspects of bills of rights around the world we should definitely not adopt for Australia. And a good example is the United States Bill of Rights, which sets things in stone and transfers, I think, too much power to the courts. So we can put that to one side and focus on what's worked and I think what would work adequately within our own system. Given that we're now last, it's not surprising that issues of better protecting human rights have been part of public debate in Australia for many years. It's been national, federal ALP policy to have a national human rights law, a Bill of Rights or the like since 1969. Attempts, of course, were made by the Whitlam government and the Hawke government to bring about this reform. But interestingly, the first attempt to achieve a Charter or Bill of Rights or Human Rights Act, and all of this language is interchangeable, wasn't by the ALP, it was by the Queensland Country Party. It was actually the Nicklin Country Party government in 1959 which introduced into Parliament the first attempt at a legislative Bill of Rights in Australian history, and that failed. But what it demonstrates is this is an issue that crosses party lines. You will find vigorous opponents to a Charter of Rights in the ALP side of politics, people like Bob Carr, and equally you will find vigorous supporters of the reform in the coalition side of politics, people like Malcolm Fraser, or I would say a number of current coalition members of Parliament, if you only have to read Hansard to see that. This reform has, of course, been achieved in Australia now in some places, here in the ACT in 2004, in Victoria in 2006. The Tasmanian Premier recently announced that that state would also move to adopt this type of law. Western Australia had a successful report chaired by Federal Liberal Member of Parliament Fred Chaney, which also recommended the change. And we're seeing the change occurring quite significantly across the state jurisdictions. But of course, what we've got now is the once-in-a-generation chance to address this at the national level. And I'd immediately say that even if we have these instruments at the state level, we also need it at the national level. You need it at both levels because we're a federation. And the way these models work is they check public power wherever it's exercised, both at the state and federal level, and they need instruments at both levels. They both have parliaments, they have courts, they both need decent human rights protection. On 10 December last year, the Rudd government announced its national human rights consultation, and that, of course, is now underway. I remind you that submissions close on 15 June and encourage you to put in a submission into that process. It needs to be a popular process, an Australian process, not something that lawyers are too heavily involved in. And that committee will report to the government by 31 August of this year. Personally, I'm confident that that process will lead to strong community support for this change. I'm confident because that has been the experience now in four jurisdictions around Australia just in the last couple of years where the support has been overwhelming. It's also matched not just by the people who put in submissions but by the opinion polls. In fact, if you look at the polls taken over the last 10 to 15 years, they have consistently shown strong community support for adequate human rights protection. In 1997, it ran at 72% in favour of a Bill of Rights. In 2006, it ran at 69%, and it roughly ranges between 65 and 80%, depending on the poll. But I've never seen one lower than about 65% taken at the national level. In fact, what you also find is that when the inquiries run these processes, the support increases significantly. In Victoria, it was 85% at the end of our process. And that was because, if nothing else, a lot of people who thought we already had it suddenly came in favour of the reform when they realised the protections did not exist. And basic factual information was a very powerful dynamic in changing people's minds that they actually wanted the protection they already assumed they thought they had. And many of the people who say no at the moment are people who believe they have protection that actually does not exist. That's why I believe that the real support in the community is closer to about 85%, and that matches what these inquiries have shown. And that's why I think we will find on the back of the Brennan panel strong recognition in the community, and I understand they may take their own poll to back this up in addition to the submissions, strong recognition in the community that people do want a national law that properly protects their basic human rights. Well, I want to turn now to whether Parliament itself needs a Charter of Rights, and I really welcome the opportunity to focus on Parliament. There has been too much debate that has neglected the fundamental and central role of Parliament when it comes to human rights. In fact, my starting point in supporting this change is that I think we need a Charter of Rights, not because I want to transfer power to the courts. I don't think that's a good outcome, though I do think we need better checks and balances. I support this because I think a well-drafted charter will improve the workings of Parliament, will improve its scrutiny function, will improve its capacity to recognise and protect the human rights of Australians, and in particular will actually add a voice to the proceedings of Parliament, the voice of Australians who are too rarely heard in these corridors and in these chambers, the voice of people who often are marginalised and disadvantaged and often simply are passed by the by in debate and don't get the recognition that they deserve. I do need to acknowledge that my own thinking on this has changed significantly. This was not the view that I had 17 or so years ago when in 1992 I worked as a very young law graduate at the High Court. I was very lucky to work in 1992 in the year that the High Court decided the Mabo case, the free speech cases. I worked there in that year and worked on those cases and saw the full majesty of the High Court and the possibilities of judicially led development of human rights, the possibilities of the courts striking down laws, of developing new human rights standards. And at that point, and for some years afterwards, I must acknowledge, my strong view was that the best way to develop human rights through implications in the Constitution, the High Court filling in the gaps, and the High Court finding ways through to better protect human rights. But my mind has been changed about that. I no longer believe that a court-led process is the best way to protect human rights. In fact, the model that I will propose to you today has a role for the courts, but it's largely a minor supporting role. I believe that an Australian Charter of Rights should have its engine room Parliament, and that Parliament should play the leading role. Well, why have I changed my mind? There are really three reasons. The first is having seen too many violations of human rights, I believe that the real game when it comes to human rights protection is not giving remedies in court, damages or striking down laws. The real game when it comes to decent human rights protection is prevention. How do you have a system that means that the problem does not occur in the first place? That means you must get the laws right in the first place through adequate deliberation, debate and scrutiny. It also means the policies and bureaucratic and other action needs to be formulated in the right way. So we actually need a system that's not focused on after the event when the damage is done, and that's what courts do, but focused earlier in the process in a way that actually deals with prevention. The second reason is that, again, having done more work now as a lawyer and representing especially disadvantaged Australians, I see the real problems in human rights protection or the lack of it is not often in the big cases that get reported in the media, but the day-to-day work of service delivery by government. It's the day-to-day work in aged care, in mental health, in disability, in adequate housing and other areas that never will get the media attention, where people can't afford to go to court in any event. And we actually need structural and systematic changes that lift up the significance of human rights in those areas in a way that will benefit the largest number of people, particularly Australians who rely upon those services, who often at the most vulnerable point in their life find that the absence of human rights protection is particularly telling in the way they are treated. Now, I don't want to suggest that those services by and large fail, but I do want to suggest that there are too many examples where they do break down. And in fact, there would be strong benefits in having many of those services better delivered. The third reason I've changed my mind is that I think with the benefit of hindsight, it's possible to see that some of the big achievements of the court in 1992 have not lasted the distance. That in fact, it is right to be sceptical about the capacity of judges and courts to deliver lasting reform. That's because in the end, I think you must navigate the difficult pathways of partisan politics to actually achieve lasting reform in Australia. To get something to stick that changes community attitudes, cultural attitudes, it does need to be run through democratic debate, through a deliberative process, and that needs to occur on an ongoing basis. That's why anything that's run through the courts ultimately won't, I think, achieve the larger agenda of reforming the value of human rights in this country and reforming more generally the processes by which we're governed. Well, that said, and given my shift away from the courts to Parliament, that still begs the question, does Parliament need reform? Is Parliament doing a good enough job when it comes to the protection of human rights as it is? And my answer to that is clearly no. I think Parliament is not doing a good enough job. I immediately want to recognise the strengths of Parliament, the role of the Senate, the quality of many of our representatives, and many of the positive things about our democratic system. But I simply say to you, I think it can be improved. I think we can do even better than what we have at the moment. And I think part of being a constitutional lawyer is understanding the need to strive always for something better. Constitutional law and democracy is a continual evolution towards better processes. If it's static, the odds are you've missed out on a capacity to improve the system. And what's interesting about our system is just how static it is compared to other nations. Well, firstly, I think the system is inadequate when it comes to the basic processes of Parliament. Fundamental issues of human rights, including the human rights of the most vulnerable Australians in the community, are not subject to adequate scrutiny when Parliament makes laws. And that's, of course, particularly the case when any side of politics controls both houses. There is no provision in the standing orders for the systematic, detailed examination of human rights issues. Under Senate Standing Order 24, there is a generic requirement for the Senate Standing Committee for the Scrutiny of Bills to look at whether bills or acts, and I quote, trespass unduly on personal rights and liberties. But the whole idea of personal rights and liberties is nowhere defined. It's not set out in a way that gives a mandate to that committee to do its job in a more detailed way. And I think if you want the system to work, you've got to give Parliament the tools and information that it needs to actually hold government to account more effectively. I'd also say that partly because it lacks a mandate, that bodies like the Scrutiny Committee are often unfortunately ignored at the very time when they should be the most powerful in terms of pointing out problems. I'd simply say from my own experience in looking at many, many reams of laws on anti-terror issues over the last decade, that the Scrutiny Committee reports often did not have much of an impact. They certainly had little or no impact in the media. Another related problem to parliamentary processes is that human rights arguments often simply lack legitimacy within Parliament. They don't have the force that they should. And this is a very strong comparison to, say, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, where raising an argument about human rights is a forceful and telling argument. That is not the case as it should be in Parliament. Human rights arguments are raised, they are referred to, but rarely compared to other bodies, and they're often not used in a way that's decisive or effective. That's partly because when human rights are referred to, well, there is no standard of Australian human rights that could be used. When human rights are referred to, what needs to be referred to is usually the rights that come from the United Nations. And they themselves have a little taint of illegitimacy when it comes to the minds of some Australians. They're outside of our system. They're certainly not part of our law. So in Parliament, if that's the best thing you can refer to, UN standards, it's no wonder they don't have the effect they should. To give you an example of that, when we had the debate a decade ago about mandatory sentencing in the Northern Territory, which led to record rates of incarceration of Aboriginal people, particularly women and children, there was a report from the United Nations Committee which found that the Northern Territory laws were racially discriminatory. The response from the Chief Minister then of the Northern Territory was twofold. He said, if the UN says this is breaching human rights standards, it's probably a good indication we're on the right track. It gives you a sense of the power of those standards. And secondly, he said, lest I'm wrong, and I quote, he said, bugger off. And that was his response to the United Nations standard. I think it would have been different if we had an Australian standard with legitimacy that actually could not have been ignored. The final problem with process is simply the speed and volume of lawmaking by parliaments today. I mean, let's be honest about this. Parliamentarians are not able to read the laws that they pass in their entirety. They can't, because in many cases the laws are introduced so quickly that it's physically impossible to read them before they're passed, and I'll give you an example of that in a moment, let alone the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages and thousands of pages of regulations and the like. Parliaments pass laws all the time and disallowing or not disallowing regulations all the time that vast numbers, if not the majority, if not in some cases all parliamentarians, would not have read. That is just the nature of our system, and it's the way the system operates, let alone not, even apart from read, let alone analysed, let alone thought about in detail, let alone actually scrutinised. I mean, our parliament has so much volume of work that is the nature of the system. I'll give you an example. The Northern Territory intervention legislation is back in the news with the announcement by the government will restore the Racial Discrimination Act, as I think it should and is right to do. If you look at the parliamentary history of the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act in Australia, it can be neatly summarised in the House of Representatives in this way. The legislation, and it was a package of legislation of 480 pages, was introduced on 7 August 2007. That 480 pages was passed the same day. If you want to look at the debate over the issue of whether it is appropriate to suspend racial discrimination protections, I point you to Hansard between 9:02pm and 9:15pm, and a total of about four lines of debate. Now, that's one of the most important parliamentary decisions in recent times, to suspend the principle of non-discrimination on the basis of race. Yet that was the scrutiny it had, and that 480 pages went through the reps the same day. Couldn't have read it, let alone scrutinised it. I do want to acknowledge that the Senate did a better job, but still not a sufficient job in the time that they had. Again, at a point where both houses were controlled by the one side of politics. That's far from an isolated example. I can give you even worse examples relating to anti-terror laws and the like, where known problems were not recognised and still the legislation was rushed through. It's not just a problem of process for Parliament. Of course, it is of outcomes. If we just look at recent history, the fact that we have suspended the Racial Discrimination Act twice in the last decade, once for the Northern Territory intervention, once in the context of native title, the fact that we've had laws on our books and still the capacity for the detention of children seeking asylum in circumstances where they may not get an adequate education and where it's been found conclusively that the conditions of their detention have led to vast numbers of them suffering mental illness. Where Australia has enacted 44 anti-terror laws over a period of time where they average one every 7 weeks in circumstances where courts can now be closed through conclusive certificates. Non-suspects can be detained at the request of ASIO in circumstances where that detention cannot be adequately reported by the media, even if mistakes are made. And a range of other issues that simply indicate to me that the outcomes don't match what we should be having. And I would say these are outcomes that are fundamentally different to outcomes elsewhere. Even in the anti-terror context, there are elements of our laws that you will not find even in the United States because we've gone further in some of those respects. Now, I do want to acknowledge that these issues can be fixed by Parliament. Parliament, having made mistakes, can fix them. And take the example of children in detention. Laws have been passed that substantially fix that problem. But again, my focus is on prevention, getting it right in the first place. And I don't think it's adequate to say it was fixed some years after the event, after large numbers of sometimes unaccompanied children suffered mental illness. We need a system that actually puts those human rights issues front and centre before a law is made, not because political debate invigorates the issue down the track. I'd also say when it comes to national security, I can point to laws still on the books from the 1920s that shouldn't have been passed then. And there are too many examples of laws just staying on the books indefinitely. There's just not the political will to actually fix past problems. I think what these examples and the processes demonstrate is that Australia does have a human rights problem when it comes to the processes and outcomes of Parliament. If you ask, what's the check and balance in Australia? What is the check and balance when it comes to vulnerable children or freedom of speech or the number of other rights that are an issue? The answer is, in large part, our system depends, often solely, upon the wisdom and common sense of our elected representatives. Now, that's an important check and balance, but it is not sufficient. By itself, it is not enough. And that is recognised as not being sufficient in every other democratic nation, I think, is something that we should take heed of. It means that if it's about wisdom and common sense, when it comes to debates dominated by fear in the community, dominated by issues of outsiders, dominated by questions that for which there is opportunistic or political or partisan advantage, that wisdom and common sense very quickly takes second stage to what might be the political considerations. That's the nature of Parliament. I don't actually have a problem with that. That's what Parliament does, is to represent those political considerations. But the role of the system is to put checks and balances on those considerations, to say that in making political judgments, you do so within a framework that means that certain fundamental values must be respected. I want now to turn to the question of, given I hope I've established that we do need some reform, well, should it be Parliament or the courts that actually leads the way in this area in terms of the design of a model? And often this debate is reduced to a simple question. Who best protects human rights? Is it Parliament, as we have at the moment, as almost the sole protector, or is it the courts who we should give power to? But I would say that's a fundamentally misconceived question. Our whole system is not based upon that either-or type of question. It's not based upon giving the power to courts or Parliament. The whole idea of the separation is that power should be shared and checked amongst institutions. For me, the question, who best protects human rights, should be answered, neither institution by itself is sufficient. Neither can do a good enough job by itself. We need a system that has a role both for Parliament and the courts. I say this because experience demonstrates that a purely parliamentary model does not work. Self-enforcement when it comes to human rights does not work. It doesn't work because the political considerations are often too fierce and too strong, and any model based upon aspirations and self-enforcement, whether it comes to Parliament, the courts, business or elsewhere, is usually just premised upon a false idea about the desire of that institution to check itself. Queensland has had a self-enforcement mechanism, the Legislative Standards Act of 1992, which is designed to require the Queensland Parliament to take into account human rights systematically in drafting laws. It just doesn't work. I've spoken on many occasions to people in Queensland, including people who deal daily with that legislation, and it's something that can be too easily ignored. There are no checks and balances that go with it, and when you have in Queensland, as elsewhere, the possibility of laws being passed on the same day that they're introduced, self-enforcement just gets dropped by the way. Well, I think we need then Parliament and the courts for a few reasons. One reason is that, as I've suggested, if you talk about effective protection of human rights, I think you need Parliament and another body. I think the processes and outcomes demonstrate the need to have a body like the courts also involved in the system. That's particularly and especially true because of the possibility that any one party will control both houses of Parliament. Anything that's based upon Parliament alone must deal with the reality that Parliament may be controlled by one party that may not have interests, whoever it may be, in respecting certain human rights. Second, I'd also say that even when Parliament does its job well, it deliberates in an effective way, I still think there is a need for judicial involvement. Parliament's got many strengths as a deliberative chamber, but it's also got some weaknesses. It doesn't have the analytical capacity that courts have. It passes laws often in the heat of the moment. It doesn't have the ability of hindsight, which courts have when they look at an issue after the event. There's also a critical difference in focus as between parliaments and courts. Parliaments pass general laws that usually apply to the whole community and look at issues through that lens. Courts look at cases through the perspective of the individual litigant. Their job is to assess the impact of a law upon the individual, and that can often throw up issues that simply were not thought of when Parliament made a law. In fact, that's why the two systems are so complementary in our separation of powers. You do need general laws made, but you do also need a mechanism to assess the effect of general laws upon individual citizens. And without that, without the courts doing that role, it would be lost. Again, the argument isn't the courts should replace Parliament. In fact, the court-based system would fail, in my view. Parliament needs to lead the way. But you do need a complementary system based upon the separation of powers. The third reason you need both is that I actually think you need the courts to bring out the best in Parliament in its deliberations. Self-enforcement doesn't work. In fact, I think you actually need an incentive for Parliament to properly deliberate and involve itself in scrutiny. And I've seen again and again an effective incentive to get parliamentary committees to work properly, to give more time to debate, is the possibility that after the event, a law might be scrutinised in the courts or perhaps even struck down if there's a constitutional problem. And what the possibility of post-enactment scrutiny by a court does is actually have a big impact on the quality of pre-enactment scrutiny by Parliament. Just take the example of the 2005 anti-terror laws, which were going to be passed in the space of about 48 hours. The possibility that they may have had a constitutional problem led to a much better committee process, led to extended time, and the sort of debate that only happened because of the possibility of scrutiny after the event. I think you need that after the event possibility, just to keep parliamentarians on their toes, to know if they don't get it right, if they don't do the job properly, then there could be some consequences, even if that's limited in some cases to embarrassment. Well, given that conclusion about the need for a complementary model, I want now to turn to the parliamentary rights model, which is the model that I favour. A parliamentary rights model is not a term that I've coined. It actually comes from a number of people, including Canadian political science professor Janet Hibbert and others, who've identified this particular model as being a parliamentary model of rights protection, and it needs to be distinguished and contrasted immediately from the United States Bill of Rights, which is a much more court-centred approach. The parliamentary rights model can firstly be found in New Zealand in 1990, then in the United Kingdom in 1998, was then adopted in the ACT in 1994, and finally in Victoria in 2006. It's a model that's been around for some time, and again, we've got evidence as to how it's working, and the claims that might be made can be assessed against that evidence. When we talk about a parliamentary rights model, we're immediately talking about an ordinary act of Parliament, and that's a very important aspect of the model. Parliamentary sovereignty is retained. An ordinary act of Parliament can be amended over time, could even be repealed. Though I would say none of these models has ever been repealed, because once they've come into force, universally they have received bipartisan support. Though in the United Kingdom, that's actually somewhat needs to be altered, because there the bipartisan support is limited by the fact that the opposition wants to repeal the model but replace it with something even stronger, so actually bidding themselves up in that system. But an ordinary act of Parliament is the centrepiece. It will contain a review mechanism which requires its review on a 4 or 5 yearly basis to ensure that it is amended as needed. These instruments are not set in stone. The ACT model itself has just recently been amended to significantly improve it. And it's also a model that would protect the basic rights that Australians assume they have anyway. I would be starting with things like free speech, the right to vote, and other freedoms. I personally would also be dealing with rights like health, housing and education, which I think do go to some of the most fundamental concerns of people in the community. What the model would do is ensure that these rights are not treated in a way as if they're absolute, but treats them in a way that they need to be taken into account in making laws and in key decision making. That means they are front and centre, an issue like free speech, for example, in determining how anti-terror laws work or what can be reported by the media, or things like non-discrimination when government departments are doling out housing or dealing with other like issues. The process itself, under this parliamentary model, has its biggest impact before laws are made. And one of the interesting things about Victoria, which actually demonstrates it's working, is the fact that so few cases are getting to court because the engine room process is working well. It gives a statement of rights which are used by decision makers in making policies, and it's now being used extensively in Victoria for this reason. Public authorities, that might be government departments and the like, must take account of the charter rights when they deliver services like aged care and the like. When we're dealing with new laws in Parliament, every new law introduced into Parliament must be accompanied by a human rights statement of compatibility, whereby the executive makes a statement as to whether the rights in the charter are complied with. Now, this statement of compatibility is one of the most important elements of the Charter. It seems weak in some ways just to require the executive to say, well, we're complying with the Charter or not. But it's actually one of the strongest possible instances. What it does is it means that decision makers, before a law gets into Parliament, draft a law, if at all possible, to be compliant with the human rights. They deal with the issue before it gets into Parliament because they don't want to have to declare that the law breaches human rights. They know they can't, as has occurred on many occasions, slip things through in a way that just ignores the human rights issue. They've got to be upfront and transparent about it. It also means that if the government does want to breach a human right, let's say it wants to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act, it would need to introduce the Northern Territory intervention legislation with a statement that says, we know that this legislation is racially discriminatory, but we wish to pass it anyway for these reasons. And it could do so. It has the authority and capacity to do it. But that sets up an entirely different level of accountability and scrutiny that would force a government to pay the political price that it should pay for deciding to breach fundamental human rights. It has the capacity and power, but would actually have a decent debate, not 13 minutes in the House of Representatives and a media and community debate about these issues. It also would greatly enhance the role of the Senate. It would actually provide a platform for enhanced scrutiny around these human rights issues in a way that would give a real mandate to the Senate and other parliamentarians to debate these issues in a forthright manner. The bills themselves could also or should go to an enhanced committee in the UK. It's the Joint Committee of Human Rights that looks at these issues with a specific mandate to take submissions from the community, to listen to the public debate and to actually reach an assessment about the impact of the law upon the human rights of the broader Australian community. And that will be informed by the government's decision as to whether it wishes to breach or not human rights. But the role of the Joint Committee for Human Rights in the UK is one of the real success stories, and it's had a big impact on improving the quality of deliberation within Parliament. The courts themselves would have a very limited role after laws are made. They would have the role of interpretation, as they do at the moment, to interpret laws where they can to be consistent with the human rights in the Charter. That's what they do anyway, using international standards from the United Nations. It's a routine argument in courts to say, interpret this statute this way or that based upon the Convention on the Rights of the Child, for example. What this would say is, do that against the standards of our domestically enacted instrument. Do it against that standard. Some people have suggested that this could turn the courts into becoming de facto legislators, that they'd use this interpretive function somehow to become super legislators. And in particular, people often point to the UK case of Gaydon and Godin Mendoza, which is said to be the high point of judicial activism under the type of model that I'm talking about. In that case, it concerned a UK law which said that if two people lived in a government tenancy and one of those two people died, provision was made that the partner could take over the tenancy rather than being evicted. And the obvious justice of the case would be you could have a couple who lived there for 40 years and only one person's name was on the lease. Here was a capacity that the other partner could take over the lease rather than being automatically evicted when the housing went back to the housing stock and went to someone else. What the law actually said was that you could only take advantage of that as the second tenant if you were living with the original tenant as his or her wife or husband. They were the key words. And the question for the court is, what does that mean when it comes to a same-sex relationship? Can you extend this to a same-sex couple? Now, some people have said that the language is man and a woman. It wasn't man and a woman. It's were they living as wife or husband? It was the key question. And the court said, yes, it is possible that a same-sex couple could, as tenants living in the same accommodation, be treated as living as husband and wife. And they used the Human Rights Act to reach that interpretation. And I acknowledge that without the Human Rights Act, they probably wouldn't have got to that interpretation. Now, that's the highest point, if you like, of judicial activism. I'd say about that case that I actually think that demonstrates the sort of work that courts should do. They should be looking at language and interpreting it in a just and fair way. I agree that that case is at the margins. That's an extreme case, if you like. I think still it got it right. But if that's an extreme case and that's the worst we've got to put to this issue, well, I'd have to say the fears really are not borne out. In any event, it just isn't going to work that way in Australia. In Victoria, when I drafted the charter there, we added particular words to mean that in the Australian context, you couldn't even get that case in the same way. The UK says, if at all possible, interpret statutes to be consistent with human rights. We added words like this if the interpretation is consistent with the purpose of Parliament. So we made explicit and additional reference to Parliament and limited the capacity of the courts so that we knocked off cases that might in any way go beyond Parliament's intent. I'd also say that people who worry about the courts becoming super legislators need to take a look at our courts. We have very conservative courts in this country when it comes to these issues, far more conservative than other nations. If anything, my concern would be that the courts wouldn't robustly take up this role, that in fact they wouldn't take it up in the way they should. These dangers are simply misplaced if you understand where our courts are and how they operate. The most that a court could do is that if it can't interpret a law to be consistent with the Charter, it could declare that the law is inconsistent, but the law is not struck down, it's sent back to Parliament to be looked at again. So the courts have a role of identifying laws where there is a problem and sending it back to Parliament to be looked at again, but they can't make that decision itself. And in the UK, it's been very successful, where Parliament has consistently responded, say, yes, you've identified a problem, we'll enact and make a change, often in areas like mental health and a lot of areas where statutes which are very old have not been looked at and there are fundamental and continuing injustices. The last topic I want to address is, on the model I've described, the parliamentary rights model, what does the record show? What does the evidence show about how this actually works? Firstly, is it going to be a lawyer's picnic? Are we setting up a model that is going to enrich lawyers and do so in a way that will just shift matters to the courts? Well, the answer to that, again, is clearly no. And the evidence here is irrefutable. The United Kingdom now has evidence over the course of 11 years. There's separate evidence in individual jurisdictions in places like Scotland. And what it shows is that the Human Rights Act in the UK is used extensively, but in cases that were already being run on existing points of law. So what it does is that if you are a citizen who might be challenging the power of government to do X or Y in the area of mental health, where you're bringing the case and this argument may shift the balance a little bit in your favour, it can have quite a big impact in outcomes in existing cases by shifting power a little to the side of the citizen in cases where perhaps their rights and dignity are not being adequately respected. But in terms of increase in litigation, the stats show that it's say in Scotland less than or actually about 0.25% of the total. In the whole of the UK, less than 0.5% of the total. I mean, it's so small to be almost statistically insignificant. It has an impact, but it has an impact in making cases be run more effectively and more justly, not in new cases. It's been the same in Victoria. Depending on how you count it, there might be about 7 or so cases in Victoria, a large number in the ACT, but they're all, I think, in fact, in every one of the ACT and Victoria cases, they were cases that were being run anyway. These are not cases, additional cases. These are cases that are being run now with the benefit of human rights. In Victoria, only one case has actually been won under the Charter. So when we look at the number, well, only one's actually been successful. And that's because government has got it right in the prevention aspect. In that particular case, a case handed down just in April of this year, a case called Craik and the Mental Health Review Board, it was found that a mentally ill man's human rights had been breached, and he won the case on the Charter. He had been forced to undergo drug treatment by the state, but his case had been ignored for years and his human right to a fair hearing had been breached by, quote, a deplorable and inexcusable system failure, which denied him reviews of his medical treatment in a reasonable time. This was a case where somebody was forced onto medication by the state and the state did not have a process to review his medication within a reasonable time. And that, for me, is exactly the sort of way the Charter should operate in enabling that person to get adequate systemic reviews of his medication and to deal with a policy that probably had been on the books for many years. Has the model undermined parliamentary sovereignty? Well, again, if you spend any time watching or being involved in any way in the debates in parliaments, then it just doesn't work as an argument. I've been very lucky. I've spent time in the United Kingdom observing the debates in the House of Commons. I've spoken to their legislators. And what they've said directly is this works for us. It actually gives us extra tools of deliberation. Through the committee in particular, it means that we've got extra scrutiny functions. Parliament is doing a better job. And if you suggested that somehow Parliament in the United Kingdom has become subservient to the courts, they'd think it was a joke. I mean, it just doesn't happen. I mean, the House of Commons has not been reduced to a non-sovereign entity by virtue of this instrument. It simply does what it should do in actually giving them human rights as part of their debate. It's been the same in Victoria and the ACT, where this instrument has played a valuable role in focusing upon Parliament, but you couldn't seriously suggest that Parliament has lost its sovereignty or it's been undermined. If anything, as I've suggested, it's enhanced the sovereignty of Parliament by improving its capacity to scrutinise and review executive action. The last question about the record is really, well, has it made a difference to people's lives? And I think ultimately we must judge on this basis, amongst others. There's no point passing a law in this area unless there is evidence that shows it actually will help to improve people's lives. In the UK, there's a legion of evidence, and you could go, for example, to the recent November 2008 report of the British Institute of Human Rights, which has looked at a decade of action on the ground in this area. And I quote from its report, it said, after 10 years, the human rights is protecting vulnerable people from abuse and poor treatment in public services. And immediately you get a sense of where it's working in the UK, protecting vulnerable people and preventing people being subject to poor service delivery. We could do with the same, I think, in Australia. It is working in the UK. In Victoria, there are a number of cases already. It only fully came into force on 1 January this year, so it's early days in Victoria. But there's the example of a single mother and her children who were about to be evicted from public housing. The charter was used to prevent her entering into homelessness. It was just used to load up her case and her advocates in a way that they could actually argue her case and get a different outcome. Many of the cases in Victoria and elsewhere are just dealing with policies and standards of long standing that nobody's looked at, that may have a real injustice according to people's lives, but still, hasn't yet led to a change. It's helped a 19-year-old woman with cerebral palsy to obtain support services and case management. It's led, in the case of Victoria, to an additional $2.75 million being allocated to assist children with autism spectrum disorder. It's had a big impact on kids with disabilities. It's assisted an elderly woman with a brain injury to get access to critical medical assistance that she may have been denied because of her age. And they achieved a common sense solution. In her case, she actually had a problem with her hand, which meant that her hand was opening and closing. She, after 3 years, could not get medical attention. She wasn't on the priority list. She was told that she may get medical attention, but that would be because her hand might need to be amputated because it was getting so severe. She just didn't fit in the category of getting attention to prevent that occurring. Just a common sense outcome won in the end, where her advocates were able to use the charter in her case to say, surely in this case you've got to not deny this person their rights and actually give her the treatment she needs. Now, I would say about those examples in Victoria, not one of those went to court. Not one. In fact, I'm not even sure how many lawyers are involved. Mostly in Victoria, it's just advocates who work on behalf of people in the community, in mental health services and the like, assisting them in those sort of cases. But it is also leading to important systemic change in Victoria, particularly, for example, through the Victorian Department of Human Services, the largest Victorian department. It's responsible for hospitals, aged care, ambulance services and a range of community service agencies. I recently heard a talk by the secretary of that department, and she talked about how they are using the charter there to revise all their law and policies on involuntary detention for mental illness, to get a more just and humane system for mental illness in that area, to change the rules that relate to disability housing and to have a different model where people can participate more actively where they have disabilities in public housing, reforming family violence. And we've also asked for volunteers within that department, and she's got 110 volunteers who are driving cultural change within that department to ferret out policies and practices to make them more consistent with fundamental human rights. What it's done in Victoria is empowered people, both people who may have been on the wrong end of a government decision that's clearly unjust and against common sense, but also empowering people who work in departments to revise their policies. It's a catalyst for delivering services better. I don't want to suggest it's perfect by any means, and in fact, I'd also acknowledge that perhaps it's only in a generation we'll know fully that it's had the impact that we really want. This is about long-term structural change to deliver better governments and better services in Australia. I would in conclusion say, though, that I think if we are seriously interested in protecting human rights in Australia, which I think we must be, that we do need to acknowledge some of the deficiencies in the current system. We do need to acknowledge that Parliament could improve its role when it comes to the protection of human rights. And we do need to acknowledge that Parliament ought to be front and centre of any reform agenda when it comes to human rights protection. It's for those reasons that I strongly support reform. I do think we need a national human rights law, and I do think on the basis of the experience and evidence from both in Australia and around the world that we can draft a model that will improve the workings of Parliament and also improve the lives of many, many ordinary Australians. Thank you.
We have about 12 minutes for questions. If I could ask people who do want to raise questions if they could find their way to the microphones at either side of the auditorium, or this share this microphone down here if you like, and we will have to finish about quarter past.
Hi, I'm Jamil Shibli, representing Justice and Governance, a community-based organisation. My two questions to the panel here is that why Australia hadn't signed the United Nations Convention on Human Rights. And recent days we see frequently the family law courts violating some kind of parents' rights, like father's rights, and the children are becoming alienated or estranged from their fathers or male parents. And this discriminatory practice or violation of the child's rights and the father's rights are very prominent. What are you going to do about it? Thanks.
Well, the first question was asking why Australia hasn't signed some of these international human rights conventions, and the answer is we have. In fact, Australia is one of the very best at international citizenry when it comes to signing up to international human rights conventions. better even than the United States and many other countries. When we signed those conventions, we adopted an obligation to make those conventions part of our law, which we never did. We're in breach of international law, and this, I think, tells a bit of a story about Australia, that internationally we have, I think, with some past disturbing exceptions, a justifiably good reputation on the international stage. Don't forget that H.V. Evatt, an Australian, was one of the leading drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I think we should be very proud of that. What we shouldn't be proud of is that every other democratic nation has recognised the value in taking those international standards and putting it into our law. We haven't. There's something, you know, that's wrong there between the dichotomy of what we do internationally and what we do at home that perhaps is only explained by a level of complacency about our human rights problems that I think we need to acknowledge. The other question was about issues of child protection and the like. Look, I would say that in Victoria and elsewhere, child protection is one of those areas that charters and human rights standards have a lot of work to do. Very difficult issues. And policing is another example as well, where they have a lot of work to do. I think the value of a charter is not that it directs the outcomes in what can be very difficult, often traumatic cases, but it does ensure that when decisions are made, they are made with the benefit of understanding the rights of fathers, of mothers, of children, of others, and that decisions are made in the most respectful and just way possible, but doesn't direct the outcomes. It can't, and there needs to be room for individual discretions, but exercised according to what I think are, you know, a just and fair criteria.
I might go over this.
Good. My name's Andrew Hopkins from the ANU. I'm interested in questions of enforcement and remedies, and I wasn't clear in your model how it works. On the one hand, you said that if one's successful in a court, the judges will send the legislation back for review, so that's the nature, that's the remedy. On the other hand, at the other extreme, you've got a situation where individual claimants are getting outcomes without ever going to court. Now, I guess my question is there a role for an individual litigant to go to court and get a remedy enforced in their favour?
And yes, most of these don't go to court because I think a good law operates in the way that the standards are clear and you don't need to litigate. So I think a good model says keep it out of court as much as possible. It's too expensive, access to justice is too difficult. And indeed, I would say that if we start getting large volumes of litigation in the court, then there's something wrong with the way it's actually operating. The court needs to be there, though, because in the end you've got to have a remedy. And sometimes governments do make decisions in a really bloody-minded way. Sometimes that I think there does need to be a remedy for. In Victoria, you've got the remedy of having statutes interpreted where possible to be consistent with your rights. If that can't be done, sent back to Parliament to be looked at again. But also, and I didn't get to develop this in my talk, a range of remedies around administrative law, which mean that if a government agency, for example, in aged care, is just breaching a basic right, you might seek an injunction to prevent that occurring. You might also seek a decision to be reviewed and remade. And this just actually fits within the existing system. You don't invent extra courts or tribunals. Bodies like the Administrative Appeals Tribunal do what they're already doing, but can also use human rights standards in review. And that's a UK experience where most of that sort of action, if you like, is in the administrative realm, just fitting into that realm and rather than actually getting into court. In Victoria, the right to damages is specifically excluded, so you can't get any money out of this. It is available in the UK. And that's one of the questions that should be on the table. I think damages should be available because I think if it's demonstrated that somebody suffered a harm for which damages is the only adequate remedy, then you know, I think it's appropriate that that's recognised.
We have a question on the other side.
Hi, my name's Caroline. Thanks very much for your talk. It's really interesting. I have a question about the role of the courts and in particular the dialogue between courts and Parliament. And in the instance where the courts have said, well, this law isn't consistent with the Charter, I wonder what the experience of overseas jurisdictions is or what the evidence of overseas jurisdictions of Parliament's responding. And in particular, that example you gave of the tenancy where the court interpreted in favour of same-sex couples, did the legislature say, did they turn around, and this is maybe a cynical view, but did they turn around and go, no, we actually did mean just man and wife, and contrary to what the court said?
Thank you for that question, Caroline. The UK experience is that, no, in cases like that, Parliament, where you're dealing with what could often be a fundamental injustice, that they don't make those changes. And if you're dealing with a same-sex couple, let's say, who have been living together in public housing for 50 years, and an elderly couple, and one of the people is about to be evicted because they don't fit within the definition, it would be unlikely a Parliament would intervene in that case, because I think in this day and age, people can see that there's an injustice being done, and the cases we're dealing with, no, but Parliament lets it be in those interpretive cases. What happens with the inconsistent declarations where it's sent back to Parliament? You can't fix it by interpretation. In the UK, in every one of those cases, Parliament has responded. So they've said, we acknowledge there's a problem. But Parliament responds in its own way. The courts identify a problem. It's up to Parliament to work out the solution. And that's where you retain the sovereignty. So a court says the mental health system's not working, there's not adequate review, or the like, and Parliament, in a sophisticated way, has a debate, it goes through committees, they work out a new legislative scheme with the benefit of the court decision, and then enacts that scheme. And in the UK, it's worked very well, I think, because the courts have identified it, but then it's very quickly moved into the political realm where it should be, and actually working out what the solution is. And that, look, that's why in the UK the system is really described as one as being very consistent with the separation of powers. It recognises the limits of those functions, recognises also what they can do and not do, and actually does do that in a way that leads to demonstrably better outcomes when it comes to human rights protection, especially, again, in those areas of service delivery and vulnerable people, which is where it should be directed at.
We'll keep going from side to side.
My name is Sheila Kernan. I've been living here in Australia since 1966. I notice you talk a lot about UK, and you may hear that I am originally from UK. And in health, in checks and balances, health service, terminal sedation for a terminal illness, it's just quite a high profile talk among people, but we don't have the power to do anything about it. As you know, the Northern Territory did bring in a thing about it, but the federal government was able to
override.
Yeah. So it's the same here with the territory here, the ACT. We can't make anything in that area, and I know there's 75 to 80% of people would like terminal sedation in a terminal illness. Now, it is euthanasia, I suppose, to a point, but it's not that big one where you can say, I'm tired of life. You just, you know, I'm just going to commit suicide. And if people want to commit suicide, who's going to stop them anyway? You don't even need a law for that. But I do believe that when you get to a certain age, you could need this assistance. And I've had that with my husband, who had a very bad stroke, and he's just on the bed with, he's just his heart beating. I did manage to get him morphine. The doctors are quite good for that, but they really want it down in black and white.
Look, I can deal with that issue, and that does often come up in these contexts, the issue of voluntary euthanasia. It's a question of drafting more than anything else, and this is why I really encourage people to get involved in the national process that's going on at the moment, because we have an open slate as to what it might cover. And I think you've got a couple of choices. One is you could have a charter that does deal with those issues. I mean, it's a question of you could put something in there about the right to life or the right to die, as it's referred to in the United States, and you could include it in a way that recognises it. I would say under my model that even if you put it in, Parliament will still have the final say. This isn't a strikedown mechanism. So if Parliament says we want to ban voluntary euthanasia, well, the Charter can't stop that. If they take the price and say this is the way we want to go, well, they will win on that. And I'm happy to live with that consequence, because I think that's the nature of the model I'm talking about. I think, though, what's more likely in Australia is that probably we will end up with a Charter, if we get a Charter, as I hope we do, that will deal with the rights that have very broad and general acceptance in the community, that maybe even over the 90% level, which is what we did in Victoria. It's why in Victoria it excludes abortion-related rights for the reason that that was left solely to Parliament without any work for the Charter to do in that area. And I think a government may well say, if we go down this path, we will simply excise areas like euthanasia and abortion and the like and focus on free speech and the like. And that may be for political considerations, perhaps, or it may be for design, that you just stick to those issues that have support. But all of those options are open. I'd simply say, if you care about these issues, send something in. I mean, this is a process to give people a chance to say, I want this in or this not in.
I'd just like to add, you do need a framework of checks and balances, there's no doubt about it, so that it will stop abuse. And then the big word is choice. I mean, you've given a choice, and if you've got the right checks and balances and you're seriously ill and you're not going to get any better, it's much better to free up a hospital bed anyway, to go. You know?
Look, let me give you one very quick example I think illustrates that choice, and that is in the UK, a couple in a nursing home there where the couple had been together for many, many years, and one of the couple actually developed a disability for which she needed a new bed. And the nursing home said, we'll give you a new bed, but it's only a single bed, that's all our guidelines allow. And she said, well, I've got the money. I'll pay for a double bed because I want to continue sleeping with my husband. And we've been together for many, many years. And they said, no, our guidelines only will allow you to have a single bed. And she was given a single bed and they were separated for 18 months. And, it's just one of those really basic indignities that has such a big impact on your quality of life and your choice, as you're saying. She actually got some advice finally from a welfare rights centre there in the UK. They went and talked to the nursing home and said, well, she's got a number of rights here about family life and other things. And they said within 3 hours, OK, we'll get you the double bed. And that's how these things work. It's how they should work. You know, a simple thing that in the end you think, that's stupid, it should have always worked that way. But on too many occasions it doesn't work that way. We give you a little lift in how you actually deal with agencies.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Everybody, if you'd like to join me in thanking Professor George Williams. Of course, this is part of our occasional lecture series, and the details of the next lecture will be on the Senate website shortly. They may already be there, and there'll be some information about the series that you can grab on your way out of the auditorium today. Thanks for coming along, being such a great audience.